few episodes ago, I talked about Micro being a modern Unix text editor, but I made a bit of a faux pas because I started my modern Unix adventure in the middle of the alphabet. So today, in modern Unix, A is for Actuin, I think is how it's pronounced.
How do you spell that?
Like the turtle out of Discworld.
Is it? So it's spelled A-T-U-I-N.
Yeah.
This means something to you, does it, Mark?
In the Discworld series of books, the world is a flat disc that rides on a turtle called Great Atuin.
Ah, well, okay, then this is enlightening. So the Atuin I am referring to is, in another sequence of segments, a magical shell history.
What shell are you using at the moment? I know in the past you've used different shells. You've used fish and all kinds of stuff. Is that what you're using at the moment?
I have been using fish for about 10 or 12 years now, yeah. So I'm still using fish.
So that's the letter F sorted.
So yes, so Atuin is a magical shell history supercharger, and it supports Bash and Fish and ZSH, and for the cool kids in town, it supports New Shell as well. Now, Atuin has a number of cool features, and I'm just going to run down a few of those that I have found particularly useful. The most useful, in my opinion, is the fact that Atuin can be installed on all of your workstations, and it can back up and synchronize your shell history into one place. So now your shell history is the same across terminals, sessions, and your machines. And you can query your shell history from forever.
I'm not sure I like this. This sounds like voodoo and I don't like it.
Does it perform any sort of segregation of that history so you can say, oh, I know I did that on this machine and I just want to look through the history of this machine, or, you know, I know I did it on that machine, or is it just all of it, whatever order it happened in, is in a timeline?
So yes, it stores lots of additional context around the commands that you execute. So each time you run a command, it stores the exit code, the current working directory, the host name of the machine it was on, the session it was in, and how long that command took to execute. All of those things are now available to you in the search filters. So not only can you bring it up a bit like your shell history, I'll explain more about how this works, and sort of scroll through it and type a query in, you can actually run queries from the command line to say, give me everything on this host where I ran make yesterday. So you just see those make commands because you know you did something that you're trying to recall. So it's got very rich sort of query language for how you can inspect your history.
Okay, I'm sure it's wonderful. I have a mental model where I know where things will run. And so the thing that freaks me out is the fact that it's aggregating. Obviously, this is optional, but it's aggregating the shell history from lots of machines. I know this particular machine I do this thing on. And one of them is a Mac. And so some of the command line things that I do there will definitely not work on anything else.
Right. So I'm delighted to tell you, you won't have a problem with this because I felt the same way about this. So it doesn't interfere with your existing shell history. So the way that I actually use Atuin is like this. The up arrow for my shell continues to invoke the shell history from my shell in the usual way that either Bash or Fish or whatever does it. But Control R, I bind to Atuin, and that gives me the full screen search. So when I'm sat here at home and I know yesterday I ran something on my laptop or my other workstation and I want to recall it, I can now Control R and search my history of all of the things and recall that item. And as you type your query, it narrows down your search and it puts 1 to 9 next to the current line. So it's a bit like launching a hotkey. So anything that's numbered, you can alt number in order to launch that without actually having to scroll all the way up to hit it. It's absolutely fabulous.
And how does this actually work? Is there like some demon sat in the background monitoring all of your shells, or is your shell doing something after each command to tell Atuin, record this?
You can do both, I believe. I've got it running as a daemon, and I'm running an Actuin server. So the project provides a server that you can use, a publicly available server. You sign up for an account and you generate an encryption key and your stuff goes up there. Or you can run your own. So Actuin has its own server. So I'm running a server here, and I also have some of my history on their public servers because I used that to sort of get started with it all. And one of the things you can do is set an interval for how often the synchronization happens. So automatically in the background, my command history synchronizes, and it's a two-way sync every hour. And you can import your existing histories. So the first time you come to Actuin, you can seed it with whatever history you have available. So when I did this, because I too am a data hoarder, I have a shell history that goes back 15 years and I do prune it from time to time. I tend it like a beautiful garden. So I gave it another round of cleanup and I imported that. So I think I have around 40,000 distinct commands in my history, which are now queryable by Actuin wherever I may go.
So there's a popular thing people do where they run history and then pipe it through a bunch of machinery in order to find out what their like top 10 most run commands. And for everyone, it seems, if you're a software developer, often Git is like one of them. But for most normal people, it seems like CD and LS are the two most popular commands that anyone ever runs on a Linux system. Does it have a way of exposing those kind of like popular commands that you use?
It has a built-in statistics generation. So yes, you can just run stats and get a breakdown of everything imaginable, including a Git style sort of heat map of which days your most distinctive new commands were executed on and stuff like this. So it's a bit of fun, but it's extremely useful. And now I no longer back up my shell history in my dot file managers. I have this database, which is always accessible to all of my machines, and then a discrete history on each machine. Because the beauty is that if I start with an empty history, but I've just synced from Actuin, I can query Actuin, run the command, and that's now in my local history as well.
That's pretty cool. Might have to give that a go. I'm one of those tedious people who has an EV, and as such, I am compelled to talk about it all the time. Yeah. And some questions come up quite a lot when people who don't have an EV are interacting with someone who does have one. And I've had mine, it'll be 2 years in December this year. So I'm a relative newbie, if you think of all the people who have Nissan Leafs or OG Teslas and stuff. But I wanted to have answers to some of the questions people often ask. And I've hand-waved some of it. People always ask about range and charging and, what the charging infrastructure is like and all that kind of stuff. And often I hand-wave some of these questions away with like woolly answers, it depends. And, what's charging like? It depends, because it does. It depends where you are and, how you're charging and all that kind of stuff. And I wanted to be more data-driven, and I wanted to get data from my car to be able to answer some of these questions with facts rather than hand-wavy answers. So what I did was I got some data and I put it into my employer's platform. Axiom is my employer, and I wanted to put the data in there because it's got tools for building dashboards and a great query language for rummaging around in that data. So that was what I did. I got the data and I put it into Axiom.
Where did this data come from? Did you wgetmy.car.com or something?
I'm glad you asked. There's two things here. There's the ongoing data and then there's the historical data. And I wanted to answer the question based on the historical data. I didn't just want to start capturing data now and then be able to answer the question in a year's time. I wanted to get the historical data for what I've done with my car. And it's a Mini manufactured by BMW. And BMW have a personalized website where I can go in and turn on and off options to do with the car. But one of the options is to download my data archive. And so it's a bit like downloading your Twitter archive or, you know, your Google Takeout or something like that. You press a button, verify your password, and then in a couple of days, you get an email, click through the email, and you get a zip file. And the reason why I was more interested in the history is to be able to query the 18 months worth of data about my car. And the thing I'm most interested in is the charging history, which is something that is provided. You end up with a zip file that contains an XML file, which has entries for all the different features that the car has, you know, how many doors it has, what model it is, every single feature that the car has, options and, you know, everything. And there's a base 64 encoded PNG of the car in that XML as well, quite amusingly. And there's a JSON file that comes with it, one big JSON file, and it has an entry for every time the car was charged. It's the full charging history of the car. And it's quite fascinating because it has information in there about the location it was that the car was charged, the state of charge before it was charged, and the state of charge after it was charged, as in battery percentage, the time and date in Unix format, of course, and also the street address of where it thinks the car was when it was being charged. And so that allowed me, once I got that data, I mean, it's just a JSON file. And in the 18 months I've had this car, I've charged the car according to that JSON file, like 530 times or something like that. And I uploaded it into Axiom. And then I started playing around with the query language. And the query language is, it's a bit like Kusto, which is a Microsoft query language. And I was able to build little queries and say, it's a bit like SQL. You know, you select from this table where address is not equal to, and then my street address, because then I can only look at data that is external public chargers, or I could say show data that's only related to my home charger. And so I could split those two data sets and look at how does the car behave differently when it's at home, when it's away. Or some of the interesting things I found, one interesting thing was that I charge away from home so little compared to how much I charge at home. Mm-hmm. And I was able to build a little table that showed my favorite charging location. So my favorite, it's the ones I visited the most, right? And it gives the street address of each one. And there's one that's at the top of the list, and the street address was just B4122 or something like that. And I was like, where's that? What is that? And it turns out it's a charger on the B4122 or wherever that whatever the road is, in a place called Chippenham, which is about halfway between my house and my son's girlfriend's house. So I have charged at the Chippenham services a few times when I've been taking my son over to see his girlfriend. He now uses public transport, but at the time, I found that was interesting that that was the top charger, because I charge on the way there and on the way back because it's too far for the car to make it on its own on one charge. I can also aggregate like how many kilowatts I've got from each charger as well, and how much draw there was from the grid. And so you can see the difference between the amount of energy you've pulled from the grid and the amount that actually went into the battery of the car itself, which is quite interesting, I think. So some stats then for you. I've charged in the last 533 chargers, 464 of them have been at home. So that shows the proportion of how much I charge at home and how much I charge away. In fact, almost every day I charge at home, but sometimes I go for days without charging at all. And sometimes I charge multiple times a day. So it's not once per day, every day. It varies, because sometimes I do a big journey and I have to recharge and then go out again. And more often than not, it only trickle charges a little bit overnight. There are sometimes errors, like people complain about the charging stations like being off or broken or unable to charge your car. And I have had 16 of what's counted in the JSON as business errors in there. And the business errors are basically something failed, unplug it, plug it back in again. And I've had 16 of those failures. And interestingly, half of them were at home and half of them were public chargers. So actually, I've only had 8 failures to charge away from home. Now, often you phone the company up and they reboot it, or you just unplug and plug it back in again. So of the 500 some charges, 8 of them failed, which I don't think is too bad. It's not great, because I've never had a petrol car fail to fuel a petrol station. So, you know. So yeah, I created a little dashboard. So now I've got this dashboard. It doesn't dynamically update because the data is a one shot that I downloaded from BMW. And there is an option for me to sign up to get API access. And I signed up and it takes ages to get approved. You have to wait days for BMW to approve your access. And I actually got rejected. I think because I'm not a business making an app or a website. I'm just an individual. And so maybe there's another way I can get that data. But I only got the rejection email today, and it was over a week ago I applied for API access. So I might have to try another route to get that access so that I can get the ongoing data. Or I could just keep doing a download once in a while of my whole data and just re-upload it each time if I want to, because it only creates a record every time you charge the car, and I'm only charging about once a day. So it's not like it's like hyper updating this file on a regular basis, but it was fun and it was cool to make charts. I actually did this as part of a hackathon we had internally in the company. We had 3 days last week where you could work on anything you want that either builds on the platform or improves the platform in some way. And all the developers did super cool stuff. And here's me with my little dashboard with little graphs of when my car was charged and all that kind of stuff. But it was fun. It was fun. And I'll write a blog post that goes along with this that gives all the details. And so you can see the actual charts and that kind of stuff.
I'm interested in what you said about it having stats for how much is drawn from the grid and how much goes into your car. Have you been able to sort of notice any difference in that, especially compared to your home charger and public chargers or AC chargers and DC chargers in terms of efficiency?
I haven't queried that, but I could. All I've done is look at what the difference is, and it's like 10% at most, right? I think. There were a couple of spikes on the graph. I did plot that on a graph, and there's a couple of spikes. And I think that's where the data is mangled, when the charge didn't work or something, you know, where it pulled a kilowatt from the grid, but didn't actually charge because the charging failed. And then you end up with a massive disparity because the zero went into the car. So those are anomalies. Most of the time, the graph just looks normal as it charges every day at home. But it was super fascinating to me to back up my assertions that generally charges work fine. And generally, if you charge at home, everything's fine. But when you go onto the public charging network, there can be problems. But I also found it interesting that as a human behavior, there are certain chargers that I favor more than others. I've used lots of chargers, but of those chargers, there's only like 12 that I've used more than once. There's a lot that I've used once and never gone back to. The other thing to note actually is the data needs a little bit of a cleanup. When I first got the car, my own address was wrong. It had the wrong house number in the data. And so that shows us two different locations, because there's a house down the street with a different number that is supposedly my house. So the data needs a little bit of cleanup, and I'll probably get to that, and it might make it look a little bit more reasonable. But other than that, it's been good fun. But yeah, I'll write it all up in a blog post.
I got a fully Googled Android phone.
Uh-oh. I misread that. I thought it was a fully de-Googled Android phone, and I know which phone it is. And I thought, wait, what? How?
So my old phone, which was a OnePlus 5T, which I'd had for 3 or 4 years now, was failing me because the USB port was knackered for the second time. I'd already opened it up and replaced the USB port when it stopped charging, and the replacement USB port has also failed. It was still charging most of the time, but it wouldn't do a data connection, which was quite important because my new car supports Android Auto and I couldn't plug it into my new car.
Right.
And given the state of the built-in infotainment system, I wasn't going to put up with that. So I went looking for a replacement phone, which was about the right price and supported Android Auto. And ideally, these days, I buy my phones used because there's enough phones floating around there that in decent condition that I don't need to generate more e-waste by buying a new phone. So I went looking around and I found a site called Mozillion, which is nothing to do with Mozilla, despite the name.
How weird.
But it's essentially an online marketplace for used phones, whereby people can list a phone they have, you then offer to buy it for the agreed price. They then send the phone to Mozillion, who do the checks to make sure it's in the condition they said it was and everything works. And then they send it on to you.
That sounds like a very good service.
Yes, and it worked very well for me because in this case, it was listed as a pristine phone and they received the phone and they decided it wasn't pristine. So they called me and they called the seller and agreed a slightly discounted price, sent me pictures of what they saw as the damage to it and made sure that I was happy with that before they then sent it on to me. It was just a few sort of minor cosmetic things. It was basically in perfect working order as far as I was concerned. So yes, full marks for them. The phone itself is similar size to a OnePlus 5T. You don't get phones that are much smaller than sort of almost 6 inches diagonally these days. It's slightly slimmer and taller rather than shorter and fatter, which fits my hand better. So that was quite good. I did often find myself sort of juggling my OnePlus 5T in one hand, sort of having to rest it on the corner and wave my thumb across. But this fits me a lot better, which is good. So this is the Pixel 6a, which is the sort of budget version of the Google Pixel. It's a slightly cheaper build. It's got a plastic body, but it's not cheap plastic. It's still good and has a solid feel to it. And, you know, you wouldn't want to have it thrown at you or anything.
So you've used this marketplace to get a previously owned phone. What era of Pixel is this? Because I'm not up to date with that anymore.
This is the last generation of Pixel. The current version of this is the 7A, although you can still buy the 6A new. I saw it advertised in Tesco last week, for example. But if you wanted the bang up to date, you've got the Pixel 7 and the Pixel 7A. So it's, you know, been around a couple of years now, I think. Probably launched in 2021, if I remember rightly. So this one, I imagine this one had been used for about a year before it was sold. So as I said, this is a fully Googled phone. This is running Android 13 with all the Google you could possibly have on a phone, which was interesting because I've not had that since the Nexus 4, I think, was the last phone I bought from, which was a Google phone.
When you say all the Google stuff, I'm thinking the usual suspects like Gmail, Google Drive, and that kind of stuff. Is there like a whole load more?
Yes. So quite often if you buy a phone from someone like Samsung or, let's say, my experience with OnePlus, what you'll get is something that's built on AOSP plus Samsung's app suite or an open source app suite plus some bits and bobs or, you know, some third party proprietary thing that you've never heard of. Whereas this is Google everything, Google Contacts, Google Calendar, right. Google Calendar, Google, 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 all the way down, which means every time you want to do basically anything at all on a new app, even the calculator, it pops up with Google's privacy policy, which it wants you to accept before you do anything and possibly link it to your Google account. And I found that was all a bit much for me. So I went having a bit of a hunt for alternatives for all this stuff to see if there were decent sort of basic utilities that I could install instead of all of the Google stuff. And I found a suite of apps called Simple Mobile Tools, which is essentially an open source set of core apps for Android. So it has all the things like the photo gallery and the calendar and the file manager and a note taker and a contacts app. And they're all open source. They're all following a similar style, material design kind of styling and UI. And they're all open source. You can get them from F-Droid. And I just started going through and seeing how many of these were a decent replacement for the Google version. And I found pretty much all of them, with the exception that I've kept Google Camera, because it has a lot of features which the open source camera tools just don't have. And there's enough smarts in there that produces better quality images at the end of the day. Mm. And I do also have Google Photos. I mainly use the Simple Gallery for actually viewing photos, but Google Photos has Google Lens built in, which is very handy if you want to read a QR code in a photo that you've taken, or if you want to OCR some text in a photo and be able to copy and paste it, which is something I didn't have on any phone previously and is an absolutely excellent feature to have.
F-Droid is a third-party marketplace.
Yes, it's a third-party app store specifically for open-source Android apps.
Okay. And this collection of open source apps, are they essentially the AOSP apps as was revitalized and presented, or are they whole cloth you know, new project?
I'm not actually sure. I mean, they look and feel similar to the AOSP apps that existed before Google started basically making Google versions of everything. But I don't know if they have any history in that code base or if they've been developed from scratch.
When you've installed all these replacement applications, are you able to remove the Google ones, or does it just remove the icon and keep everything on the phone?
It depends. So I'd say the majority of them could actually be uninstalled, but a few of them could just be disabled.
Mm.
So you've been able to reduce the clutter on your phone by disabling or removing the bits that you don't need?
Yes. And migrating, so before I was running Android 10 on my OnePlus 5T, which was, I think, Oxygen OS was their spin of Android. And I'd previously moved from OnePlus 1 to a OnePlus 5T using OnePlus's migration tool. In this case, I actually used a built-in Android transfer feature to do a transfer over Wi-Fi. So it could just see, I didn't have to install any other apps. It just found it as another Android phone and did some handshaky stuff and then did it over Wi-Fi. And what I found there was a few apps synced their original settings. Most apps needed to be set up again and signed into accounts. But there were also quite a few, especially the open source ones, that had a decent export-import feature where you could just say, write my settings to a file. And then I used KDE Connect to ping that file between the two phones and then imported it in. And it was just like it was running on the old phone. So that was quite a nice experience, sort of three different levels of synchronization there. But in almost all cases, I was able to keep the configuration from the old phone.
Did you say you sent the export files directly from one phone to the other via KDE Connect, or did you go via a piece? Because I've never seen that as a use case that anyone's talked about for KDE Connect. It's always been connected to your computer and then access things on your phone or expose features of your phone on your desktop, but never like direct peer-to-peer transfers. It's not something I'd considered.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah, any KDE Connect running device can see all of the others and do whatever is supported between them. So yeah, if you have someone else in your household who you want to be able to ping stuff to, you can do it via KDE Connect.
Huh, nice.
Or between households, if you use a zero tier.
I knew it was coming. Oh, one other thing that I wanted to mention about Android 13 is, so the phone has no hardware buttons or sort of soft hardware buttons. It will optionally display the home, back and app switcher. But what it recommends is gesture navigation.
Right.
Which was brought me screaming back to the Ubuntu Touch days. It uses very similar gestures, swiping across the side to go back, swiping up to get the app tray. And I sort of thought, well, I'll try it, but I don't know if I'll like it. But actually, I find, especially with the size of the phone and the way it fits my hand, I'm sold.
Nice.
Yeah. I turned those gestures on my OnePlus and used it that way for many years. And fortunately, the Android tablet that I have also supports gestures. And I found my path migrating to iPhone way easier than my wife's, because I'd spent 2 years of basically using the same gestures to move about the phone that the iPhone uses.
Nice. Would you recommend the Pixel 6a then?
I think I would. I would definitely recommend Mozillion for buying a phone. If you don't buy a Pixel 6a.
Nice.